You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, May 28th, 2014. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is the award-winning podcast, The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. On today's program, an interview Sam recorded just this week with Daniel Shulman, author of the blockbuster new biography of the Koch brothers. They'll take you inside their incredibly bizarre world and explain how these two brothers just came to occupy so much power in American life and politics. And then on the better half, the fun half, Matt and I are going to be back at the helm, and we are going to bring you a bunch of stories, such as...
That LulzSec hacker, Sabu, who became an FBI informant, finally got his day in court. Let's see how he was treated. And also, we have a story about a wonderful, I guess you can say specialist, professional, who would like to tell you the real reason that fed that shooter in California. And it's not misogyny, I'll tell you that much.
And then I'm actually going to explain why misogyny was a pretty big part of what happened and why we need to get real about that. Also, Ben Carson.
I don't know, we're not specialists here, though. We're not professionals.
That's
just because we
point.
Think it's misogyny. I don't
That's
know.
A good
Maybe
point.
We should leave it up to those who...
I'm waiting for my mail order diploma that these Fox analysts get theirs from. So I can comment with the same authority on mental health issues. Seriously, wherever they got their degrees should be incredibly embarrassed. Also, Ben Carson has a novel explanation of the VA hospital, really going out of his way to prove that his brilliance as a surgeon not only doesn't apply to other areas, but that he's in fact lopsided, as in brilliant here, total moron over here. And obviously your IMs and calls and...
Before we get into the Sam interview, though, I think we should mention that early today the news broke that legendary author, poet, speaker Maya Angelou died at the age of 86. Very sad. She's an important voice.
Very, very, very sad. And I know a lot... I'm glad you remind us to bring that up. I know many people were really moved, obviously, and influenced by her as a, I mean, just really, I guess first and foremost, as you say, as a poet and as an author, but really, I mean, someone who helped.
I mean, an activist, really.
As an activist, she was involved in, you know, in supporting Malcolm X and supporting the civil rights movement. She also had connections with, you know, and spent significant amounts of time in Africa. So there was a very, like, global dimension to what she pushed for, you know, through the 1990s. I think Bill Clinton having her at his first inauguration was very culturally significant. I know many, many people, including myself, who were very moved by her talent, her intelligence, her elegance, her power, her compassion. It's a sad day, but obviously it's also very much worth remembering that she did live a long and healthy life and really just, I mean, you know, contributed profoundly. And that's, I guess, all that's probably the most anybody can ask for. And she accomplished that and more. So glad you remembered that. So we honor Maya Angelou's memory today. And which we should be mindful of it every day. Also, And I think some people are pointing this out. She was also wonderful on Sesame Street. So she even had, you know, that. She just was kind of interacting with people and helping people in so many different ways and expressing her art in so many different ways. So obviously, rest in peace to a significant American icon. We'll be right back with the author Daniel Shulman on his new Koch Brothers biography with Sam's interview with him. We'll be right back after this, and then we'll take you to the fun half. Thanks for listening.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program the senior editor of the Washington Bureau of Mother Jones Magazine and author of the latest, Sons of Wichita, Daniel Shulman. Welcome to the program, Daniel.
Thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
This is basically a biography of really the Koch. I guess the Koch family, is a better way of putting it.
Yeah, it's a biography of the four Koch brothers, and one of the things that had interested me in the first place was that, you know, when you heard of the Koch brothers, you would really only hear that really referred to Charles and David Koch, but in fact, there are four Koch brothers, each of whom are fascinating in their own way.
Yeah, tell us why, when you decided to write this book, what it was that inspired you to do so. I mean, it's obviously fascinating stuff, but, I mean, did you have a sense of that there was a fascinating sort of family saga here, or was it something else?
You know, I sort of, the original thing that interested me is in the 2010-2011 timeframe, you really saw David and Charles Koch becoming sort of political villains. And it was very much you were very much seeing a caricature of these guys. So I was thinking, their real story must be much more interesting. And then as I sort of did a little research on the family and their origins, I realized they had this fantastically interesting family saga, in some ways tragic, because of this 20-year or longer feud that played out, about 20-year feud that played out between the brothers. And, that was sort of the dimension of the story that really attracted me early on. Because obviously their political rise is fascinating, and the business story is also an excellent one. But adding that family drama piece into it, I think really made the narrative richer.
Yeah, so let's start with the patriarch, with Frederick. Tell us about Frederick Koch. Where did he come from, and how, I guess, his politics certainly guided at least Charles and David's political perspective. So tell us about Frederick Koch.
So his origins, basically he was born in a small town in the Texas Panhandle called Quanah, and his dad was owned a local newspaper. His brother went into the newspaper business with his dad, but Fred Koch didn't see a future in that. This was at a time when, you know, during his childhood was when there was just a boom of the use of automobiles, and there was a huge national thirst for gasoline. So Fred Koch studies chemical engineering at MIT. He joins a partnership with a couple of other engineers in Wichita in the mid-1920s, and they begin selling a refining process around the Midwest. Fred Koch and his partners get sued by basically a consortium of the nation's biggest oil companies who had basically bought a company that owned a refining patent. And they were basically trying to be the predominant purveyor of this refining process. So Fred Koch ends up being forced to look for work outside the United States, to drum up work in Europe and places like that. And one of the first places he ends up working is in what is then the fledgling Soviet Union, a place where we didn't even have diplomatic relations with them at that point. And his firm is paid more than $5 million for the construction of refinery equipment at 15 refineries. And these refineries actually provided the model for others that were built in the country. So Fred Koch ends up playing a pretty big role in helping to industrialize the Soviet Union. He spends a few months over there overseeing the work and is just absolutely horrified by the conditions people are living in. And he comes home thinking that the rise of communism is the world's biggest evil, and he vows to do everything in his power to fight against it.
Is that the beginning of him developing his sort of political outlook? I mean, I just wonder the context of, you know, I'm living in Texas in the 1920s, and I head to MIT. I wonder in what political context he did that, or was he apolitical at the time? I mean, was his father, where was his father at that point?
His father was actually a Democrat. But it's sort of a Democrat of that time.
Right.
You might consider to be more of a Republican. But, you know, I spent time in the town that he grew up in, and the paper that it's remarkable, the paper that, the grandfather founded is still there, so you can kind of go through the archives and look through the old editorials. He was basically running this thing as almost a one-man operation. So the interesting thing is on issues like the New Deal, you know, their dad was like an FDR backer. Their grandfather was an FDR backer and things of that nature. So he wasn't necessarily – his politics certainly weren't as extreme as they would become, you know, during his John Birch Society heyday. I never really got that impression. But at the same time, the grandfather was also not in favor of, you know, the sort of welfare state and those sorts of things. So I think that must have colored Fred Koch's views as well. But I think his time in Russia, combined with his experience being sued, gave him a sort of anti-government outlook, along with, you know, a real fear of the spread of socialism and its evil twin of communism.
Yeah, and I don't want to belabor this point, but one of the things that I think is fascinating about your book is to see how the personal dynamics influence the politics within the context of the family. So the grandfather, he was a New Deal Democrat, but he had problems with welfare, or did I get that wrong?
Yeah, no, you've got that right.
Okay. And so he there were aspects of the New Deal that he appreciated, but others that he didn't, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that's the best way of putting it. And he also didn't feel like, you know, the government, he also was the type that didn't really want the government encroaching on all of these decisions that he felt like should be made at a different level. You know, this town was very much a frontier town when mm-hmm. when the grandfather moved there in the late 1800s. It was you know, there was nothing really there, and he was ended up being one of the founders of this place. So this sort of frontier mentality, I guess, this sort of stand your ground mentality is very much intertwined with the history of the Koch family as well.
So Frederick comes back from the fairly new Soviet Union, appalled at what he sees. What happens then? I mean, where are we in a timeline at that point?
So he comes back in the 1930 or so. Now at that point he's 30 years old. He's not yet married, and it's really later that you see a lot of that he really becomes a staunch anti-communist when his sons, who were born between 1933 and 1940, are children. He is kind of going around speechifying against communism. In 1958, Fred Koch is literally present in the room when Robert Welch lays out his vision for the John Birch Society, and there's probably 10 other prominent businessmen in the room that day, and Fred Koch becomes basically a charter member of the John Birch Society and, you know, one of its national leaders.
All right, before we get to the John Birch Society, we should say that you write back in 1938, he is, I don't know if praising is the right word, but he is certainly showing some admiration for the Axis powers. And I think the quote was something to the effect of he saw them as sound governments overcoming the vices of idleness and feeding at the public trough. So he's really anti-communist and anti, I guess, I mean, he has a problem with what's going on in this country at that point.
Oh, yeah, and what's, I mean, it's interesting if you, you know, I was able to find a lot of letters that he had written and speeches that he had given around the country, and he really wasn't convinced that that the U.S. was going to cease to be, was going to exist past the year 1970 or something like that. I mean, I think he said, you know, this country's going down the tubes, and it's going to be overrun by communists by then.
It's interesting because on some level, and I think you tell me if his sons still sort of share that perspective. They just probably moved the timeline differently.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think in certainly you can see in Charles Koch's rhetoric. He had a piece in the Wall Street Journal recently, where, you know, using the sort of rhetoric of collectivists versus individualists and that sort of thing. The interesting thing is that not all of his sons really shared the same ideology. You know, his eldest son, Frederick, is politically liberal. Bill Koch is, you know, he gave quite a bit of money to pro-Romney super PACs in 2012, but he's also given to Democrats, and he actually was once considering running for Senate in Kansas on the Democratic ticket against Sam Brownback, in fact.
Interesting.
But it's really David and Charles who you see most heartily embracing their father's politics. At the same time, I should add that David has said in the past that he has kind of said that he felt that his dad went a little bit overboard on the anti-communism stuff and was just, you know, a little bit neurotic about it.
Well, the Charles Birch Society, I mean, that's a slight understatement on some level. I guess it depends on what perspective you judge on that. But the John Birch Society, which still exists today, but not in its well, I don't know how virulent relative to when it was launched, but the John Birch Society was staunchly anti-communist, and this, I guess, perspective also led, I don't know that it was sort of the hallmark was necessarily racism, and I don't know if that's fair to say, but they certainly saw the civil rights movement, and I think Frederick shared this, as a, basically as a communist plot, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely. They definitely thought that the that the Soviets were trying to whip up race tensions in, you know, the major cities as a way to sort of plot the way, you know, in order to sow dissension and pave the way for an eventual communist takeover of America. There's no question about that. And, of course, the John Birch Society at the time was extraordinarily controversial. And there were, you know, allegations of racism and anti-Semitism, which the group was very quick to dismiss. But, you know, one of the men that was in the room along with Fred Koch when the John Birch Society was founded was a man named Revilo Oliver, who was a classics professor, I believe, at the University of Illinois. And he would later leave the John Birch Society in the 60s because he was too controversial, but he really would become a hero of, you know, the whole the whole white power crew, because I mean, for just making a just incredibly racist statement.
What was the mechanism that they thought the Soviets were able to stir up dissent? I mean, you know, because I think, and I ask this because, you know, if you look at the modern libertarian movement, there are plenty of examples where, where racism, if it is not shared by the leaders, is certainly exploited to further themselves politically and in some instances financially. I'm thinking of, you know, Ron Paul's famous newsletters that he didn't actually write, according to him. But the exploitation of those of those people and those sentiments are certainly there throughout its history. But what was the mechanism they thought the Soviets were doing this? I mean,
I don't think it was just the civil rights movement. I mean, they literally saw, I mean, if you look at some of Fred Koch's writings, it was the civil rights movement, but it was also through so many different, through unions, for instance. He felt that unions were also a mechanism of communists infiltrating the United States. He thought that modernist painters, such as Picasso, through the very means of their artwork, was influencing the communist leanings of the country and that sort of thing. So he really, you know, everywhere he looked, he saw the slow creep of communism.
Yeah, I mean, in unions, I mean, at least I can see the logic there on some level. I mean, and let's get into sort of the dynamic he set up with the kids, because, you know, and it's probably something that, you know, someone who's spent so much time researching and writing deeply and nuancedly about this family, I imagine it would be hard to say. But, I mean, is it fair to characterize Frederick Koch as a bit of a kook? I mean, I know.
You know, I think that, you know, this is what I think it's easy for us to put him in that frame right now. I think what the stuff that he saw in the Soviet Union and his role that he played in sort of empowering that country were genuinely horrifying to him. And that's sort of what guided him. But I think it is, if you were to read his anti-communist tract, A Businessman Looks at Russia. A Businessman Looks at Communism. You know, it's filled with passages that today just sound
crazy.
Off the wall.
Did he? Was there a certain amount of being tortured by this? In other words, I mean, was it? You know, did he have some type of major moral dilemma with basically building or having a large part to do with the industrial base of that country?
I really think he must have. And there were other influences on him too, and in turn on his sons. You know, between 1929 and 1952, he was just basically engaged in a series of lawsuits over for patent infringement. And this was just really weighed on him, and his sons could, you know, see, I mean, they could feel the tension in their home. So these are all factors that really influenced them in their sort of formative years.
Interesting. And so and he also it seems like he seems to have set up a dynamic in the home where the sons really went at each other.
Yeah, you know, Fred Koch himself was a very competitive guy. This was a very, across the board, a very competitive family. He was also a college boxer and taught his sons how to fight and sort of, you know, had them fight each other, you know, for, you know, just, you know, box each other just for sport and stuff like that. But the seeds of a bitter sibling rivalry were really sown during their childhood, because one of the other things about Fred Koch is, you know, he obviously loved his sons, but this was a gruff guy of a certain era who, you know, wasn't really that demonstrative, and he wasn't the kind of dad who played ball with his sons, and he was pretty rough on them. They really competed a lot for his love and for his approval, and you sort of see that play out later on in some of the battles.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that before we move into Charles and David's sort of entry into politics. I mean, this feud went on for years.
Yeah, and so basically what happened is that Frederick, who was the eldest son, wasn't interested in the family business. He was interested in the arts and theater, got a playwriting degree at Yale. He wasn't involved in the family business. Charles gets involved with the company in 1961 when their father's still alive. When their dad dies in 1967, he basically has taken over the company. And David joins a couple years later, and a few years after that, Bill is working for the company too. So all three brothers are working for the company in the 70s. In the late 70s, the company is under scrutiny by a number of government agencies for a variety of things, including price violations on the price of oil, and also for allegedly possibly rigging an oil lease lottery. So Bill is concerned that the company is, you know, running into all these legal problems, and he attributes this to Charles's sort of anti-government libertarian philosophy. The second layer is that there are other shareholders who are basically mostly members of the extended family. Koch Industries is a privately held company. Charles was basically plowing all of the profits back into the company to build it. And Bill and other shareholders wanted to extract some money from the company. They had other things that they wanted to do with their lives. He wanted to buy houses and art and that sort of thing. But he couldn't access his wealth. So in the end, this sort of leads to a boardroom showdown, the result of which is Bill getting bounced out of the company. A few years later, he and the other dissident shareholders come to a settlement, including Frederick. But what happens after that is Bill comes to believe that in this settlement, which nets him $470 million and his brother Frederick, who had been partially disinherited by their dad, $330 million. Basically, he believes that his brothers cheated them and had misrepresented assets and obscured profit centers within the company, and this ignites another wave of suits, in fact. And among other things, Bill in the late 1980s was, you know, cooperating with Senate investigators who were basically looking into Koch Industries for criminal violations, stealing oil from Native American lands. He was essentially trying to get his brothers branded as criminals.
Wow, and I just want to go back to at one point there. It seems that they had the Koch brothers had, or particularly Charles had a disposition like we're going to ignore government regulation because that is a function of Big Brother. And at one point, they have a turnaround theoretically or supposedly. Yes.
Yeah, I mean. Essentially, what was going on is that, you know, Charles was a very, very staunch libertarian and still is. And he, you know, people that have known him from the 70s basically say he was what you would call an anarcho-capitalist, somebody who basically who believes that almost every function of government can be handled by private individuals, thereby eradicating the need for government. So, you know, it certainly seemed that in certain senses, you know, he was operating as if there was a pure free market system, where, of course, it isn't a pure free market system. There are regulators, and that sort of thing. So what happens is in the 90s, in fact, the company just came under siege by, DOJ and EPA. Over a variety of environmental disasters, including, you know, pipeline leaks that just leaked hundreds of thousands of gallons of oil into just a variety of wetlands and bodies of water and that sort of thing. And sort of what one DOJ attorney told me is that it was not just the scope of the violations that attracted the government's notice, but the flagrancy with which these things were committed and essentially, you know, trying to cover up the fact that these oil spills had occurred. Also in the 90s, you have a pipeline explosion by a Koch pipeline in Texas that kills two Texas teenagers in the most just horrifying of ways. This results in a $296 million wrongful death award to the father of one of these victims. Part of the reason the jury goes ahead and, you know, because basically the plaintiff's lawyer was asking for like $100 million. The jury basically tripled it because they were so horrified by what happened, and there, you know, evidence and testimony was given that essentially Koch Industries felt it was more profitable to, you know, not to maintain some of its pipelines, and if something happened, to potentially pay off a lawsuit later. That they just, you know, that they were just outraged. So this is what is a point of learning for Charles, where I think, you know, he has even said, you know, this is where they come up with their 10,000%, you know, 100% compliance, 100% of the time.
I gotta say, like, when I hear a story like that, and I, you know, think like, you know, these guys are made out to be cartoon villains. I mean, that's about as close as you get, right? I mean, to being a cartoon villain. I mean, in that respect, I mean, their company functioned in such a way that there was this naked desire for profit without regard to the expense of anything else, it seems.
I mean, in that case, the facts certainly speak for themselves in terms of what happened there, and there was at least one Koch employee who gave a deposition who said, you know, who basically said he had tried to alert someone. It wasn't that pipeline, it was another one, but that there was potential maintenance issues that needed to be addressed. and was told overtly that, you know, this money would actually make more money for the company if you kept it invested elsewhere, and the company would be cheaper for the company to pay off a lawsuit,
right,
if such a thing were to arise.
Right. I mean, that's, you know, in my mind, that is one of the best arguments against the libertarian philosophy there. But let's move to their sort of more direct involvement in politics, because I think it was after that settlement in the 90s that they started to sort of ramp up their lobbyist operation. But back in, I think it was in the 80s, David was nominated as the vice presidential candidate for the Libertarian Party, and I think that also came in hand with something I've seen reported in the past, somewhere around like $500,000 donation to the Libertarian Party. Is that accurate? Is that, I mean, based upon your research?
So he eventually ends up funneling about $2 million of his own money into the 1980 campaign. And, you know, part of the whole reason for him being chosen as a Libertarian Party candidate is that he could circumvent campaign finance laws by sinking his own money into the campaign. So that was really the only reason he would have been on the ticket. I mean, obviously, he was also a successful businessman, so that helped. A lot of people that were in the libertarian movement at that point, honestly, there were a range of sort of radical elements, and they weren't going to necessarily portray the best face for this movement that was, at its heart, striving for some form of broader respectability.
Mm. And so that goes nowhere, and they eventually, and by they, I mean Charles and David. I mean, you describe Charles as really being the one who has the more political of a mind, more political strategy, and David ends up being sort of the face, sort of the part of the execution of that plan in some respects, even though David has less sort of intense political feelings, I mean, according to what you write. And so at one point they realize this isn't going anywhere with the Libertarian Party, and despite the fact that they had knocked the Republican Party in the past, they see an opening within Republican politics.
Basically, that's, I mean, it was kind of a long process for them, and even before they sort of exploded onto the scene, they didn't have the best, I mean, they had sort of an uneasy relationship with the Republican Party. There was one, but it wasn't, you know, it certainly wasn't like it is today. Mm-hmm. So basically, they left the libertarian movement behind, but while not abandoning the libertarian concepts, they just were finding another sort of party to work through. They just, the three-party idea was just too quixotic. It wasn't going anywhere, and you had all, you know, the one thing about libertarians is often you find that they can't really agree on much.
I have certainly noticed that in my dealings with them on this program. They can't it's interesting that I don't know if they were billionaires at that time. They were certainly multimillionaires when they believe that it's quixotic for a third party. It gives you an indication of just how heavy a lift that is. So so now their basic agenda is what? To just push the Republican Party in their ideological direction?
I think that's what their aim is. And I do think, you know, I actually, there's a piece that I have that's running in the Washington Post over the weekend that discusses the areas where potentially, and this might sound like a strange thing to say because the Kochs are really seen as conservative hardliners, but in many ways, you know, they are very conservative on economic issues. They are liberal on a number of social issues. So if you actually were to see them put their money where their mouths are on certain issues, and if they were to do so, they would certainly rile the Republican base. There's just absolutely no question about that. But these guys, you know, David has said, you know, he's for gay marriage. They're not anti-reproductive rights. These guys are pro-civil liberties. They're anti-war. But, of course, on the other side of that, these guys are hardliners when it comes to free market issues. And, but, you know, they don't want to just get rid of sort of welfare for the poor. It's also, you know, they're also against corporate welfare and subsidies and that sort of thing. And Charles Koch has been pretty consistent about this, you know, throughout his life. I mean, in the 1970s, he was slamming the Republican Party for being full of sort of hypocrites, kind of, who would, on one hand, advocate against welfare, but, you know, you had these business interests that were seeking subsidies and regulations that would prevent competition. And that sort of thing.
Now, let me ask you about that, too, because, you know, I've spent a lot of time talking to people who have defended the Koch brothers to me in that way, that they are genuinely against corporate cronyism. They certainly take a healthy dose of subsidies in a myriad of forms, and certainly lobby for regulations that are going to help their business. And to a certain extent, I don't think that's that makes you a hypocrite. You know, I think we should have higher taxes, but I'm not going to send in more money than I'm obligated to pay in taxes. But I mean, what did they become more you know, at one point Charles was ignoring environmental regulations, right? Because of his libertarian philosophy. They're just making an active choice not to be that ideologically pure at this point, because there's billions of dollars at stake.
I agree that it's kind of hard to get your arms around. You know, this is where it basically comes down to. On the lobbying front, you actually won't find them lobbying in favor of any regulations or subsidies. That's Koch Industries itself. And, you know, there's been conflicts within the company about this, because in some cases, yes, it is better to lobby for certain regulations because that will strengthen your market position. But, you know, they try to enforce a level of ideological consistency within the company. So there's that sort of, so they are consistent on that level. You know, the one thing that to understand about the mentality of the company and the philosophy of these brothers is it's very much an Adam Smithian sort of philosophy. Enlightened self-interest and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
If by pursuing your own self-interest, you're furthering the interests of society as a whole. And of course, we can, you know, debate whether that's true or not, you know, ad nauseum. But this is actually what these guys believe. And in terms of the subsidies, you're absolutely right that they do accept subsidies for things like ethanol and on. Now, Charles Koch's argument is basically this is the business landscape that he has to operate in. So
I actually think that's, I mean, I don't have as much of a problem with that, I think, as some, just because, yes, like I say, I use that tax analogy. It's just interesting that at one point his ideology would trump what government regulations are and the lay of the land in terms of ignoring it because it's Big Brother. And then, you know, I guess in time, as we all age and you put more billions on the table, maybe that moderates. But we just have a couple of minutes left. I have to ask you about this because it came up on we're recording this obviously earlier in the week, and this came up on the program today that in an interview you gave, you thought it was very problematic for the Democrats to demonize the Koch brothers. Tell us about that, because I'm not so sure I agree. But I mean,
here's my argument. I feel like by the level of demonization, I believe, first of all, in terms of like Harry Reid and the Democrats denouncing the Kochs, I absolutely believe that they have the right to vigorously defend themselves, because they are being heavily targeted in vulnerable districts, but with ads that, frankly, are not always factual, run by Americans for Prosperity, which is of course partially funded by the Kochs and was founded by these guys. My argument is that my theory is that the attacks on the Kochs have really helped to legitimize them in the eyes of the Republican Party. So if that's if empowering the Kochs is what the Democrats want to do, then I think they're not doing a bad job of it. But if they're trying to trying to defang these guys, you know, it's not working because they've basically created this entire mythology around these guys. And where it might be helpful is in fundraising, and you'll often see their name invoked in fundraising messages. So I do think that it's probably working on that level, but.
But do you think you can really defang guys who have, like, what their net worth now is over $100 billion?
Yeah, it's about, according to Bloomberg, it's about $100 billion. Well,
can you really defang like an ideologue who is so determined and has like a 30-year history of like putting their money where their mouth is? Now that he's got $100 billion, can you really defang somebody like that?
Well,
I don't think that's the agenda. In other words, I don't think the agenda.
This is what the Obama campaign did in 2012. Basically, what they wanted to do was show that the Kochs were behind Americans for Prosperity, because they found that by doing so, it really helped to neutralize some of the ads that Americans for Prosperity was running. Once people understood that, wait a minute, you know, some of the Americans that we're talking about here are billionaires who set this group up. Okay, well, I might not completely buy this message. So I think that was actually a pretty, strategically, that was seemed to be effective. And honestly, you know, for all the money these guys threw into the 2012 campaign, like, what did they get for it? Basically nothing.
I don't know about that. I mean, I'm in that camp that believes that the so-called establishment Republicans have adopted their principles, and that, to me, it seems to be the agenda that they set out with. And, you know, and not just Republicans, frankly. I mean, you know, when you talk about socially progressive but conservative economics, you know, it's a matter of degree. But, you know, there's a dynamic going on in New York State that's not unlike that when we talk about our governor in many respects. Obviously, his economics are not as radically conservative, but you know, this is a guy who's going after unions. This is a guy who's going after you know, imposing austerity and cutting back and social welfare programs. I mean, I guess the strategy, it seems to me, is not so much to just defang the Koch brothers, although I think that neutralizes some of what they do, but I don't think you can neutralize them as much as it's a way of motivating and sort of nationalizing the narrative that there's a real problem with money in our politics and money influencing the decision makings. Now, I also happen to think that's a problem on the Democratic side too, but in terms of electoral strategy, seems to make some sense to me.
Yeah, I just think it just seems to me that going out day after day and beating this drum, you know, people are going to just get sick of it. And I think, you know, I do think with Harry Reid, you're obviously willing to, you can obviously say whatever, you know, you want. This is politics after all, and right. Political rhetoric is overheated. I do think that getting into things and saying, you know, these guys are un-American, that's something that, like, just as a regular guy myself, that just rubs me the wrong way, you know? And I work for Mother Jones.
Right.
So it doesn't seem to me like that's the best way to go about this. But like I said, I absolutely think that people who are getting absolutely hammered by ads that are connected to a group that they have strong ties to, you know, absolutely have the right to defend themselves. I mean, I think everybody just wishes that the political discourse in general could be just a little bit more civil, but obviously that's not going to happen anytime soon.
The only pushback I would give on that is tell it to tell it to Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney when they put out that film that certainly demonized Bain Capital, and I think still continues to be one of the main factors as to why Romney was never able to recover. But with that said, the book Sons of Wichita, it's a fascinating look, and I think there's so much there that shows sort of where these ideologies to develop from, because we spend a lot of time on the program talking to libertarians that I think really does make some sense. I mean, it was like Lord of the Rings in that family.
Certainly was a slugfest. There's no question about that.
Daniel Shulman, we'll put the book on the front page of Majority.fm. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Sam.
Welcome back. That was Sam's interview with Daniel Shulman, the Koch brothers. Well, at least you can kind of understand psychologically where they're coming from, folks. Look, you all know that this show is possible because of members. That's how we're able to have an incredible level of independence in this program and make everything happen. It really is pretty amazing. And I have to say, every time I talk about it to other people who work in media, write or work for different websites or TV stations or newspapers, they are both like, wow, that's amazing. I wish I had that kind of freedom. And they're also like, oh my God, how do you guys do it? And we do it because enough of you step forward, those of you who can. So just calling out, as we do every day, go to MajorityReport/become a member. There's a number of different options for you, from the incredibly cheap, it's less than a cup of coffee a day.
It's I know there's been
a lot of dispute about exactly how much less, but it's less than a cup of coffee a day. That's the bottom line. And you know, there's more than a cup of coffee a day options, because this is a pretty great resource. So those are also available for those of you who can afford it.
There's some people who are wondering what happened between yesterday and today. I guess they missed yesterday's show.
Oh, they missed yesterday's show.
Listen to yesterday's show for the full story, but in summary, starting next Monday, Sam will be doing a regular type radio show due to Ed Schultz ending his show and Tom Hartman moving his show. And so Sam will be on regular radio,
on terrestrial radio,
from 3 to 6 every day, Monday through Friday. And the change here is little to nothing. What's going to happen here is we're just going to do it for this week, so Sam can prepare for the launch on Monday of the terrestrial radio show. And then from that point forward, Tuesday to Friday, Sam Cedar hosts this, the Majority Report. And then we're just going to do Mondays like we usually do, Matt and Mike Mondays.
Every Monday.
Sorry if I'm a bit distracted, Michael was supposed to shut off the air condition, but he didn't.
Wait till the fun half. Relax. After completely threw me off with that. All right, folks, we're going to go into the fun half of the show.
Yeah, it was really distracting, the air conditioner just turning on as I was talking.
It was already on, but
no, it was off.
Okay, as gripping as I'm sure everybody
finds this, it was like an idle mode.
We're going to go into the fun half of the program, and we will take your calls at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. The IMs are open. Become a member. You know all the other things you can do. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and subscribe to us on YouTube at YouTube/SamCedar. Fairtrade Coffee. All of the usual options are always there. But first and foremost, if you can, become a member. All right, and we will see you members on the fun half of the program.
See you on the fun half, starting now.
Hey, should we take one?
Fuck off.
This new version takes forever to start. Here we go.
She says no, 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 no.
She says no, 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 no. 'Cause you're only afraid to leave. Only a brother to leave. She's a pretty little dog who says no, 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 no. Just a little dog, and she knows I love her so. If I ask her to walk with me, she shakes her head at me. She's a pretty little doll who says no, 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 no. All the night time through, she says no, 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 no. If I ask her to walk with me, why can't she ever say to walk.